Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle.
And you know,
it's kind of odd not to hear Chris first.
I know. You know, I almost said Chris just because I'm so used to hearing him say it.
Yeah. Both of us watched Dread, the latest Judge Dredd movie.
I think there's only the second. There's only two.
Okay.
How about this? The one without Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah. So this one with Carl Urban is Judge Dredd. And I really liked it. I'm actually a Judge Dredd comic fan, so I have Judge Dredd number one, and I think all of the Eagle comic run of Judge Dredd, so.
I'd been wanting to see it for a while, because, you know, been popped up in the Tsutaya, and I'm like, oh, alright, I want to see that. But I was actually not pleasantly surprised, because I kind of, saying it was better than it had to be is kind of an insult, but like, I wanted to see it, but I was not expecting to enjoy it as much as I did.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty faithful to Judge Dredd. I really don't have a lot of complaints about that movie.
Yeah.
It was like a comic book story, like a one-issue story. It introduces Judge Dredd, it introduces Judge Anderson, that's the psychic, and it does a good job of introducing Mega City 1 and Cursed Earth, so, yeah.
Like, even though I don't have any of the comics, and I don't actually think I've read any Judge Dredd comic books, like, I knew the setting and, you know, the basic, I guess, premise and everything. But, yeah, I guess if you were coming in cold, it tells you pretty much everything you need to know. And in, you know, a pretty short or small bite-sized piece that's, you know, not outrageously long. So I appreciated not having to sit through, like, a big, you know, prequel or info dump about what was going on.
Yeah, you were saying before that it didn't have a lot of exposition.
Yeah.
It had enough.
Well, yeah, I certainly wasn't saying it was lacking exposition. You know, it as I said, it kind of told you everything you needed to know to get involved in the story. And I appreciated that I'm not doing a whole lot of exposition, because sometimes that can get really tiresome and boring, in my opinion.
Yeah, and so you were also talking about how they used slow motion or bullet time?
Yeah. It was the first, I guess The Matrix kind of had a reason, but it's the first movie I remember in a long time that actually had an in-fiction reason for the slow motion scenes that I really appreciated and I thought was really cool.
It is really cool. They actually had a Dread 3D, so we watched it in 2D. Which is fine, which is what I prefer. But apparently, their slow motion special effect also combines 3D.
Okay.
And it supposedly works really well, so that's good. So I would really recommend people go see Dread if they're fans of Judge Dredd, but then they probably would have seen it anyway.
Right.
Yeah, but if you're interested in like an action movie, I would recommend that.
Yeah, you don't even really have to be a science fiction fan to like it, because it's low science fiction.
Yep.
So, yeah, if you like action movies, as you said, I'd watch it, like science fiction movies. Yeah.
Basically, it also would be just a good adventure. Like, set it up where people would be in one location.
Right.
And have a pretty standard mission, so it'd be a good one-off or one-shot.
I was thinking that, because after watching that, I actually have a copy of the D20 Mongoose Judge Dredd RPG that I picked up in the bargain bin here for like 200 yen, just because. And seeing that kind of made me want to run a Judge Dredd game. And I'm like, yeah, they did a really good job of containing the action in one place, so the game master wouldn't have to, like, you know, scramble for all his notes and, you know, worry about all these different locations. But it never really felt, well, I mean, obviously it was confined, but it isn't like one of those huge mega blocks where you have, like, you know, 200 floors to explore. So there's a lot you can do in that one setting, that one building. So I thought it would have made a great one-shot adventure.
Yep.
And speaking of movies, I watched the Wizards of the Coast actual play of that Module A1 Against the Slave Lords that they recently put up. And I don't know. I think what they were doing was a good idea, right? It was an actual play of, you know, Mike Merles as the DM with a bunch of people who are intimately involved in the in either Dungeons & Dragons or the D&D Next playtest and design process, actually running a game. You know, James Wyatt, Greg Bilsland, Rodney Thompson, and Peter Lee, who are all kind of big names, were all players. And then Mike Merles was the DM. So it was a good idea because they were showcasing the D&D Next system. You know, it's a good marketing tool. You kind of get people excited about the new edition. You show them how it works, and you show these sort of big names running and playing in the game. So, great idea. I didn't find it entertaining. I actually kind of found it boring and just kind of watched to get through it.
I really liked the idea of them doing this actual play. They chose a product that they just released. Product was a huge nostalgia factor.
Right.
And guys that are pretty big names in the D&D community, such as Mike Merles and James Wyatt. Apologies if the other guys are huge names. And that is, I guess, a perfect venue to showcase the game and the hobby to people that are unfamiliar with it.
Right, and I watched the recording because
period.
You know, sorry, that was one of those Canadian pauses. Sorry.
Yeah, and I just didn't think it really sold. I don't think it sold the game that that they had out, and
right.
I don't think it sold the hobby, which I think is even more important.
Right.
They've got the reach to. You know, people would have heard about it. It would have been popped up on Twitter a lot. It would have popped up on Facebook and other things like that. So people may have clicked on it. And yeah, I can't see people being grabbed by that.
I completely agree with you, Lyle. I can't say anything about the D&D Next system. Because honestly, from watching that, you didn't really see much of the system in play. You kind of don't really see that much during an actual play anyway, so that didn't bother me. But yeah, I didn't see this actual play selling the game and selling the hobby. It was, for lack of a better term, it was boring. I was kind of bored watching that.
Well, just so we don't rag on this particular
right.
actual play, because we do have our own episodes up there, and maybe people could...
Okay.
Describe those as boring or not.
Fair enough, that's true. I guess...
What would you like to see in an actual play? What would you like to see in this kind of actual play? And by this I mean one that needs to sell the role-playing hobby in addition to any particular game. And I think that does raise the bar.
Right. Yeah, that's a tough one. Because, in a regular actual play... There's maybe two things I'm looking for, and they can be mutually exclusive. One, an interesting story. You know, maybe an interesting story and interesting characters. And then it almost becomes like a radio drama. You know, you're kind of listening for the story rather than the game. The other thing I listen for is sometimes even to learn the system of a game. You know, hearing someone play a game can kind of teach you how to play as well. You know, so that's something else I would listen for. But that's just in a regular actual play that someone like, you know, us or other podcasts put up. For someone in a position like Wizards of the Coast who then have to sell the hobby, I really don't know. I think they just didn't seem all that excited. I think that's what was really missing.
No, I agree. So, just to make that more general, people need to come across very engaged.
Right.
And I think you hit upon it in the first thing you said. You want to see a story being told. And I don't care if it teaches me how to play the system.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see... If I were new to role-playing, I would want to see how these dice work within the confines of this storytelling. And it doesn't mean I need to know that 18 is a hit because of X and Y.
Oh, sure.
I just need to know... What that means, how often did the dice come up? And they don't have to explain it. It just is shown to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to see people having fun in their characters, and they don't necessarily need to do the funny voice, but in an actual play that does help.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I wouldn't necessarily want people to, like, play up for the crowd. You know, that, for me personally, that would get kind of annoying. You know, I just wanted to say, just play the game. That's what an actual play is to me. You're playing the game and you're kind of letting everyone sit in and watch. And you don't have to go over the top to make it, like, super exciting. But you, the player in this actual play, still have to be excited to be there.
No, absolutely. You got to be excited to be there. And no, play for the crowd, I guess. But play the adventure. And the adventure, I mean, why don't we see a lot of fantasy comedies? Because they're probably not that good. Like, people like fantasy movies. You can have a little bit of humor. And I mean, watch the movie Dread. And the comic book had a little bit more humor than the movie, but the movie had some as well. But it didn't take away. And if people want to know what we're talking about, they can watch Judge Dredd with Sylvester Stallone with Rob Schneider.
Right, right.
Too much. Or they can, and then they can watch Dredd and they go, all right. Just contrast those two movies. And sorry for having to make you watch Judge Dredd, the first one. But I think that's something, it's good for us when we think about our actual plays, is are we delivering what we would like to see?
Right. So.
All right, well, moving on to the topic for this episode, it is a literature lesson, and we're going to look at George R. R. Martin. Not necessarily just The Song of Ice and Fire, but a lot of it will be about that. Like all our literature lessons, we're going to pull out some common themes in his stories, and themes that we think would be interesting to incorporate into your game. Or your actual play. Link. So the first theme that we have, and again, well, this does link into the actual play, is character limitations. And this doesn't necessarily mean a distinguishing physical characteristic, but it could be. And people who do read George R. R. Martin, such in the Wild Card series, he has the Great and Powerful Turtle, who is a powerful telekinetic, but he has to be, or he's convinced himself that he needs to be inside this armored Volkswagen Bug in order to use his powers. Or we could look at Tyrion Lannister, who is a dwarf. So there we have like sort of a self-imposed limitation then with the dwarf, something that you're born with. And if we look at other characters, things happen to them that limit their abilities or alter who they are. And they must change who they are based on that limitation.
That's kind of an interesting contrast, because I'd actually completely forgotten that, you know, George R. R. Martin did the Wild Card series, and then when you brought it up, I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. But the psychic guy who has to wear the Volkswagen Bug turtle shell, contrasted with, like, Tyrion Lannister, as you said, one is a self-imposed limitation, while the other is a limitation that's beyond the character's control. And at least with Tyrion, that limitation is always thrown in his face. And sometimes he uses it to his advantage, but it's something that, in my opinion, he, well, obviously tries to overcome and usually does.
I think in most of the examples that we have, the Great and Powerful Turtle, the Jokers in the Wild Card series, and right. People who are unfamiliar, just very brief rundown of the Wild Card series, there is a virus bomb that goes off and 1940s, 90% of the population infected by the virus dies, 9% turn into these things called jokers, which mean you may get a power, you may not, but you are pretty much deformed.
Yeah, not in a good way.
Yeah, and the 1% become aces, and that means they would be what we would think of as superheroes. So they get powers without the limitations of supreme ugliness. Right. And if we look at Tyrion Lannister or the other characters in A Song of Ice and Fire, all of these limitations define who they are. They're not little limitations. So Tyrion Lannister overcomes being a dwarf, but he is a dwarf. And that's how everybody views him. And that's like his cross to bear in the story.
Right.
He is who he is because he is a dwarf. It's not just added on.
Good point. I was thinking like, yeah, he is a dwarf, and while in some respects he overcomes that, as you said, it's not something that's tacked on, it's who he is. So, like, even in a scene where, or he may finish a scene where he does something incredibly clever, you know, and we see just how dangerous and manipulative he can be. Like in the next scene, then someone pushes a chair at him. And of course, because of his size, he has to struggle to get up onto it. And as you said, it's kind of his cross to bear. And while he may overcome it in some respects, it's never going to go away.
Yeah, it doesn't go away. In the case of the turtle, it's psychosomatic, but he can't overcome it. He becomes aware that there's no reason why he wouldn't be able to use his power outside of this shell.
Right.
He just can't get over it. When we're talking about the characters where it's imposed, and I don't want to reveal the names just in case people haven't seen it yet. Even though I think in the storyline, the big one, even in the TV series, it's advanced to the point where it's happened to him or her.
Right. Or them.
How coy am I? And then, but the story after that is that person redefining who they are based on this new limitation.
Right.
And that, I think that's, I hesitate to use the word courageous because it is a game. But when you're committing yourself to a campaign, committing yourself to a limitation that actually is going to affect things is huge. And I know people use the Daredevil example a lot, or it's always obliquely referred to in games where it says, well, if you're going to give yourself blindness, but then you're going to give yourself like a radar sense, it doesn't count. Sure, I can understand that. But also, I mean, he's still blind. You know, radar's not perfect.
Hmm.
And that limitation is certainly a lot more than most people would commit to.
I think this... not really a tangent, but it might get kind of mechanical. I think that's because in a lot of games, there is no reward for hindering your character mechanically. You know, there's no mechanical reward for hindering your character mechanically. Like, I'm trying to think of an example without giving stuff away. But, you know, let's say you have a character, and you know you're playing along, and you decide, okay, I'm going to impose some limitations on my character, like serious ones, and your character gets maimed in such a way that affects your character's abilities mechanically. Very few games give you some kind of reward for doing that, and of course I'm split, because there shouldn't have to be a reward on the one hand, because you're doing this for the roleplay experience. But on the other hand, if you like really hamper your character, it can be... not fun, for lack of a better term, because maybe you are just really ineffective from that point on. And why would you continue to play such an ineffective character? Especially if you have other people in the group relying on you. And I'm specifically thinking about a game like Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, where if there's a weak link in the party chain, then everybody is kind of going to suffer, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Point Wayne.
Our next theme, which is... a type of limitation, but one that deserves its own place in the episode, is forbidden love. And people may not know, but George R. R. Martin wrote, or was one of the writers on Beauty and the Beast, the TV series. And probably some of you don't even know there was a TV series of Beauty and the Beast.
They're thinking the animated Disney movie. Wow.
This was Ron Perlman's big break, and Linda Hamilton's. Not big break, because I think it came after Terminator, but it was the thing she did between Terminator and Terminator 2.
Hmm. And Ron Perlman graduated to Hellboy makeup, right?
Yeah, after Beauty and the Beast, he went on and did, I think afterwards was The Name of the Rose.
Hmm.
And he had to wear makeup then. And I think when he got up to Hellboy, he was really reluctant to do yet another role with makeup, but he really liked the script.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, it's good that he did, because then he was perfect for that role.
Yeah.
Although anybody with all that makeup, I don't know.
Yeah, but it was still his voice, and he still did have to be in a suit and act, so it wasn't like really super digitally enhanced like Andy Serkis. But...
oh, I read something where Ron Perlman, for the Make-A-Wish Foundation, he got done up in all the Hellboy makeup and visited a kid.
Ah, that's pretty nice.
Yeah, it was nice. And then just hung out with the kid as Hellboy.
That makeup must be uncomfortable, though.
Yeah, no, it takes hours to put on. It's really uncomfortable, so it was really good that he did that.
Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, and Forbidden Love.
Right. I was trying to think how to get back to it. Ron Perlman's Forbidden Love of makeup.
With a little kid.
Yeah, maybe. But I guess it's a dark place, but Forbidden Love could kind of be two things, in my opinion. Like, as you said, Lila, it's kind of a self-imposed limitation in that the character falls in love with someone that they know is either out of their reach or due to circumstances or situation, they will never have a shot at this person. That's one kind of forbidden love. And the other kind, which I just kind of thought of, is a love that is taboo, right? And at least in Game of Thrones, the TV series made it blatantly obvious, but there are a couple of sort of taboo relationships going on in that series, book series.
Yeah. Well, I think the incest is not a spoiler because that comes up straight away.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
The other one, we don't necessarily need to say. We just, it is one where society looks down upon.
Right.
Severely. So that kind of, and forbidden love, that could be something where you do go with the incest, or maybe perhaps too dark, but you go with something like a Lolita.
Right. Well, that was,
like pedophilia. I'm not sure you would ever want to go there in a game.
That was kind of in at least in the Game of Thrones series too, because you know certain characters were pretty young when they quote unquote like got married, and the TV series had to increase the age.
Well, I mean, in that respect, the age difference, that was more in keeping with what I know. I say the times. I know it's not history,
right?
But the times they're emulating. And the taboos, incest is still a taboo, but certain types of love, like gay marriage, is now getting acceptance and being legalized in many areas. I mean, but that was very taboo not too long ago.
Right.
So if you're playing a period piece, we play when we did our pulp game, mm-hmm. our film noir or hard boiled game, we made sure that if you're gay, if you play a gay character, this will be a taboo, or your sexual preferences are taboo.
Right.
You know, because it's the times. So, I mean, yeah, there's different things. I mean, it could be society says it's forbidden, or it just happens to be forbidden or unrequited due to the two personalities involved.
Right. That's what I was thinking too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're playing in a science fiction setting, or a fantasy setting, you can certainly play with certain like racial taboos or ethnic taboos by having the elf play the role of, you know, another ethnicity, in a sense, or the alien on another planet plays, you know, the other religion. So there's a lot you can play with. Yeah, there's a lot you can do with that without getting too
explicit.
Too explicit or too uncomfortable. Like, people might not want to play, you know, America in the early 20th century and interracial marriage. That might be too raw.
Because it is kind of a character limitation, right? But I think maybe the reason you thought to separate this one out, Lyle, was because, I don't know, I get the feeling that love or romantic relationships in role-playing games aren't really that common. You know, and maybe I'm wrong, but my, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Image of the hobby is that not a lot of players choose, or not a lot of groups choose to include romantic relationships in their games. And so doing that is kind of like a big step, and then going the next step and having like forbidden love is an even obviously bigger step. So I don't know. I wonder how often this happens. I'm sure it gets used a lot as scenario plots, you know. I'm kind of thinking like Romeo and Juliet here, you know, but I don't know, using between player characters, I don't see it getting used that often, which is kind of a shame.
Yeah, and we also wanted to make it separate because it involves either another player or an NPC,
right?
So it's something where And as soon as you involve another player or an NPC, you're adding to the story, or you're making it a part of the story, even more so than a limitation. So it is. It does deserve its own place.
Yeah, I mean, you can play a guy with a limp or someone who's blind all by yourself. Can't play Unrequited Love with only one person.
Well, I guess you could do the limp. Oh, let me just lean on you. Carry me.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that you don't need the other players to say, yeah, that's right, you do have a limp. You know, you just have it. Ah, actually, you could do Forbidden Love or Unrequited Love with only one player. It's like, okay, my PC is going to fall in love with your PC, and what do you think of that, dude? No. All right, Unrequited Love, I can work with that. And you're just going to keep pushing.
Unrequited.
Exactly. You're just going to keep going. You're like, man, this is great.
You're forbidden to bring that up at the table again.
Yeah, pretty much. You are forbidden from coming back.
Our next team is, what is it, the best laid plans of mice and men?
Yeah, that's how it goes, yeah.
Yeah. Like broken plans, fail plans. Things don't always go as expected. Or never go as expected.
Such as trying to play that forbidden love.
Yeah. So in Martin's works, some of his short stories, he has an apocalypse or Armageddon short story. Where people have a plan and it just doesn't go the way it should. If you look at all the schemes and plans in A Song of Ice and Fire, some work, but most of them don't.
Right.
Even in the latest book, people come with, you know, year-long plans and schemes, which can be really frustrating when you're looking at watching a movie or reading a series, and these people are able to lay these, you know, decades, century-long plans. And they work.
Oh, okay. I was waiting to see where you go, because I couldn't tell if you meant it was frustrating to see these well-laid plans fall apart or to see them succeed, but I definitely agree with you. It is kind of frustrating and, in my opinion, kind of unrealistic for people to set these, as you said, decade-long plans that, you know,
have so many moving pieces and moving parts and it all just comes together.
Exactly. Especially if the people involved in the plans are people, meaning like human beings with an average lifespan. Like I kind of, if you get into like, you know, supernatural creatures that live a really long time, well then you're like, yeah, okay, I see that happening because you can kind of keep adjusting the plan. But, you know, average lifespan people, no, there's just too many variables for that stuff to happen. And I don't know, it does get kind of tedious and boring to see it get pulled off without a hitch or with very, you know, minimal fuss. So, yeah, I definitely agree. Plus, and from a game perspective, is it more fun to have your plan succeed and you just kind of sit back and watch it go? Or is it more fun to have stuff kind of go sideways and then you have to scramble and find a plan B or do something else? So, I mean, look like TV shows like Leverage. I mean, even though that's competence porn and they always kind of pull it off in the end, there's always wrinkles and twists and they have to scramble to get stuff done. Or, you know, Ocean's 11 or pretty much any sort of caper movie or story. Do the plans ever go exactly as planned? No, because then there'd be no movie or book or whatever. So, you know, maybe in a game people, I can see people getting angry when their plans don't, you know, succeed or don't go off, but that just makes it more interesting. So I think broken plans are great. Of course, not all the time, and not to the point where you can't get anything done either.
Yeah, I think with broken plans, there's a real danger that you don't make it frustrating for the players.
Right.
So, I mean, you got to make sure the players are into, without spoiling any surprises, you got to make sure that the players are into improvising.
Mm-hmm.
And that they understand that you're trying to simulate reality by having plans fail or having plans that need adjustment, as opposed to just trying to mess them up because you want to be a very autocratic game master or something.
Right. Well, that being said, I think in this case, games have an advantage over other media because, A, the story is kind of being told as it unfolds, you know, there at the table. And also we have the randomizer, usually in the form of dice, which tell us whether actions succeed or not. And that's a big way, that's a way for the GM or the storyteller or whatever to be completely impartial. And then it's like, okay, put your plans together. Yeah, that sounds great. And, you know, the first example that pops into my head is, and now the face man, you know, walks up to that guard or whatever and starts putting the plan in motion and, you know, tries to fast talk this guard and rolls a natural one or whatever, or botches it. And, okay, maybe that's a bad example because then that happens right at the beginning. And so the, you know, characters can just kind of like run away, regroup and try again. But, like, if that happens in the middle of a heist or plans or whatever, well, then they have to adapt. And it wasn't the GM trying to block them. It was just, you know, that social contract of a role-playing game says we're all going to abide by what the dice say. And, sorry, in this case, the dice say, for whatever reason, this part of the plan fails. So, what are you going to do? Maybe you have to come up with something quick. Or maybe you have more time to plan, but you have to adapt and improvise. Go.
Yeah. So just make sure they're on board. And I suppose they'll really need to be on board for our next theme, which is no one is safe. Or danger.
Now I'm thinking of the, Forbidden Planet robot. Danger, danger. Or danger Lost robot. In Space, yeah. Oh, that was a terrible movie. Anyways.
Did you think? I can't remember it, so maybe that means it's terrible. Well, but I don't remember thinking that it was bad when I watched it.
I remember thinking, wow, this is a terrible movie, when they somehow flew through the center of an exploding planet. And I'm like, I don't think that works. But anyway.
This is the one with Matt LeBlanc and William Hurt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember that being good or bad.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
I also don't remember George R. R. Martin writing that. So we'll move on to No One Is Safe. Obviously, people die.
A lot of people die.
In life, it's a dangerous world, and I don't think there's any more dangerous series, either on TV or in fantasy fiction, than A Song of Ice and Fire or Game of Thrones.
Right.
There are no untouchables.
Right, I remember talking to you.
Well, I think we know one of the untouchables.
Right. No, I was remarking to you yesterday that, you know, kind of the problem with cop or, you know, investigation shows such as like NCIS or, you know, CSI Miami or whatever is that the main cast...
It's CSI Miami?
What?
The main problem with CSI Miami is it's CSI Miami.
All right. Apart from that, is any of those
David
shows...
David Caruso? Would that be the other problem?
All right, can I finish my point here? The main problem is that the main cast will not change, usually, you know, because they have the actors for a whole season, at least, probably the whole run of a show. And so whenever they need to kill someone, there's always this, you know, bit part actor where they're like, oh, we're going to bring in, you know, Joe Smith from Department... be over here to assist us on this one. You're like, dude, you might as well be wearing a Star Trek red shirt because you're going to get killed. And they do it to, I think, instill a sense of danger into the show. And it just doesn't work because you're like, none of the main characters are ever going to die. Same thing with Star Trek, kind of. You know, hence the red shirt. But
yeah, absolutely. And I guess Star Trek's, you know, people are going to say, well, it's not that kind of show. And you watch Star Wars, and you're like, "Oh, well, they're not that kind of movie." You know, we don't want to watch the main guys die. And yeah, that's really hard to get away from it. Well, when you think about Lord of the Rings, what was it? Nine walkers versus the
nine riders,
and at the end of the movie, eight. Oh, and it was Boromir. Mm.
Spoiler.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, and that, you know, you might as well have just given that guy a red shirt,
right?
And then you say, "Well, it's not that kind," but. When you read a series or you watch something where pretty established characters do get killed, it does put you on your toes.
Mm-hmm. Especially when major characters get killed in either pretty mundane, unheroic, pointless ways, you know?
Or when heroes get killed for doing the right thing.
Yeah, that too.
Because that also breaks the, you know, when somebody goes, well, I'm going to make the tough decision and do the right thing. And you're like, and the real politic guy is saying, no, you don't do that.
Right.
And then that person gets killed. On the one hand, you're like, well, yeah, you don't do that. But on the other hand, you're like, no, but that's not the, what message are you saying? That person was doing the right thing. They were stepping up.
Right. I think there's a lot of that ingrained in us where, you know, stories, or a lot of stories, especially fantasy, you know, say, yeah, if you do the right thing, everything will kind of be all right in the end. And yeah, maybe it'll hurt getting there, or you have to make some sacrifice getting there, but you will get there. Where in, with George R. R. Martin, it's just like, oh, you do the right thing. Nope. And you don't really get anywhere.
Yeah. And in the Song of Ice and Fire, you don't really know how it's going to end.
Right.
Now you think and hope that certain characters will not end out well, or end up well at the end of it, but you really don't know who's going to end out the, or end up the winner.
Or where they'll end up.
Or what winning means.
Mm.
Like, I mean, he's weaved everything together where you don't really know what the good ending is. Like, what is throwing the ring in the volcano? Which ending is that? Which character's got to win to do that? Because he's put a certain favorable protagonists against each other. Like, how are their plans going to resolve themselves to a mutually satisfactory way, or in a mutually satisfactory way? They're not going to.
Right.
Somebody's got to win, somebody's got to lose, or maybe everybody loses.
Right. Or hey, everybody wins. Deus ex machina. But no, I think that's a really good point, and it kind of goes along with character death. It goes along with the idea of kind of keeping things, wow, keeping it real. How about that, you know? Because, yeah, okay, some games, some genres, the sides are very black and white. But in reality, that's rarely the case. And there are, you know, quote unquote, good people and bad people on every side. And, you know, I think that is shown pretty well in George R. R. Martin stories, where you're like, yeah, there's a lot of sides to this conflict, and there are people and characters I like on every side, and people I dislike on every side, and yeah, as you said, Lyle, winning or victory or getting ahead for one side is going to mean, you know, the other sides suffer, because that's just how it is, and you're like, wow, I kind of don't want to see anything happen to any of these people, but you know something is going to, because that's just how reality works, and you never know who it's going to be.
Yeah. I two things. He doesn't like to reward the stupid.
Right.
Or the nobility at the price of, you know, doing the right, or doing the, I mean, doing the right thing versus doing the smart thing.
Mm.
And he does a good job where that, when bad things happen to noble, but maybe not the brightest people, that you, after you get over the shock, then you're like, yep, yeah, that was going to happen, because you, I mean, they made these choices.
Right.
So it may shock you, but afterwards you look at it and you say, well, that, yeah, that would have happened. And the other thing, and this gets into the thing we talked about at the beginning, the limitations, and that's, sometimes he can break a character, like someone who's very unsympathetic or you wouldn't have liked at the beginning, and then he breaks that character, and now you start to feel some sort of sympathy for that character. You start to want them to, you know, turn out okay.
Right.
And you start to root for these characters. So he's able to switch your emotions. So he's not afraid to, or your allegiance, and he's not afraid to do that.
Well, again, it kind of gets into the whole idea of being real, where no one, you know, unless they're completely broken, is a monster. So, yeah, everybody kind of has a bunch of different sides to their character. And, yeah, as you said, Lyle, people or characters who you are pretty sure are one way, you know, throughout the course of the story, you figure out, oh, either that's why they are like that, or that's why they are making these choices. And yeah, they actually are pretty sympathetic. And yeah, eventually you either start liking, or the opposite, you kind of start really disliking this character.
Yeah, I mean, and you're thinking, it's like, yeah, and after they do something horrible, you're like, oh, I want them to kill him and or her and strike her down or strike him down. And then when something happens to him, oh, but not that. Whoa, whoa.
Yeah, that's too much. Whoa.
Oh, okay. All right, now I hope this guy gets out of it, you know. Yeah. And you start to say, okay, now what's going to happen to this character? And it doesn't necessarily mean that these are good people now. You know, bad things can happen to bad people, and they stay bad.
Hmm.
But you're like, okay, it's happened, and I kind of understand you a little bit more, and I want to see where your story goes. So you follow the story a lot of times, not the characters.
Right.
And I think if people can get into that into a game, you know, like bad things happen, then everybody can follow the story, and they're all contributing to the story and how their misfortune is adding to it, of course. Somebody losing their character, you know, in the beginning or midway through a game and having to come back as something else, because you obviously still want the person to play.
Right.
But that sense of loss adds to the story and adds to everybody's story. You know, everybody now is more on their toes, including the person that just got killed off in their new incarnation.
So how do you think you would handle that then? Like, this is a little gamey, but because that always seems to be kind of a problem. And I've heard it discussed by people before where they've said usually players will react more to NPCs getting killed because there is much less of a chance of those game master characters coming back, you know? Whereas if a player character gets killed, it's less of an impact because the player is still sitting there at the table and the player is probably still going to come back and play in the game. And it's just like, oh, okay, well, another hero, because people are usually playing heroes, you know. Another hero is just going to join the group, so whatever. We don't really care all that much that, you know, whatever, Bob the Fighter died because, you know, Bob 2 will show up next game session. So how do you think you could get over that or break that?
Well, first off, at the beginning of the game, people have to know it's a dangerous world. Then once you promise that, then it has to be a dangerous world. Second, I think if you do it straight away and people aren't invested in the story, then I think then that is more shocking. And I'm not saying that you
start
plan
every
it.
Campaign by killing someone.
No, well, I mean that would mean nothing because the person's played like what, 2 sessions, and they have nothing invested in that character. And then they would come back the 3rd session as a completely new person, and no one's really much more advanced than them or more involved in the story.
Right.
But when the death happens in the middle or towards the end, then it is going to have a bigger impact. If it happens towards the end, the person might actually just be out, because what's the point?
Right.
Now, how to do that, I would say, you know, write it in, like, internally, like, you know, have it planned so a certain amount of sessions, you are going to fudge the dice, just so people can get involved and get into the story, and then after that, stop fudging it. So that doesn't mean automatically killing somebody, but that means that the game becomes more dangerous as it progresses, and that actually helps the sweet spot, if you will, because at the beginning of the game people do feel that things are more dangerous, but then as a game progresses and they keep surviving all of these situations, they start to get a little bit inured to the danger.
I see what you're
and
saying.
A bit desensitized or blasé.
Right.
So
right.
If the danger increases with the story, that should match and counteract the desensitization.
I think that's a pretty decent idea.
Now, PC versus NPC. No, that's a good question. I don't know how involved people are with NPCs. I mean, if you have these amazing NPCs, that's great. Then sure, by all means, do that. But I you know what it would be? I mean, I guess it would be if it's somebody's story, their subplot, and during their subplot they get killed off, and then everybody's just like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Because that would have been the last person they expect. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I wasn't necessarily saying that, you know, every NPC is more important than a PC or the players will react more. You know, if they walk in and, you know, someone just kills the unnamed bartender, well, then no one's really going to care. But if it's kind of like those secondary characters that, you know, the PCs interact with a lot, you know, whether it's kind of like, you know, the info dump NPC or, you know, the the wizard they always go to visit to, you know, have stuff figured out, or, you know, one of those recurring NPCs. Well, then I think maybe it could be more of an impact when that NPC dies, because, yeah, they're not coming back. But I don't know. I was thinking, if you had a game where you had a lot of, well, not even a lot of, but, you know, several regularly occurring NPCs, and it made sense in the story, well, then the player whose character died could take over the NPC. And I've talked about the game before, and still eventually want to play it, but that All for One, kind of the horror musketeer mashup, like the characters are playing musketeers, but because musketeers are kind of nobility, each character also starts with two lackeys, which are, you know, kind of very underpowered, kind of one-dimensional servants. And they're essentially like hirelings for old D&D purposes. And in a game like that, if the musketeer gets killed, I could see a player taking over as one of their lackey characters, because that kind of hireling has been in most of the adventure, and so would know a lot of what's going on, and there wouldn't have to be, you know, kind of the hand-waving of bringing this character up to speed, or the game master racking their brain about how to work this new character into the story. It's just kind of like, okay, and yeah, it's a dangerous world, and sorry you are now playing this kind of underpowered character, but that's just the character you get now. You're still in the game, just with this kind of minor character.
Yeah, like that could be played really well. I'm, you know, you're talking about it, and I was thinking about the movie The Chocolate War, which is not George R. R. Martin, but
right.
People, I mean, that's a great book and a great movie.
If you want to be depressed.
Yeah, it's depressing, but well, I mean, it's set in a high school, boys' Catholic school, and it just turned off everybody right there. Boys' Catholic school, yeah. But the way the roles reverse, like nobody dies, but roles get reversed, and that is horrible, and people can really chafe at that. But then, how do you come back from that?
Yeah, so, maybe you don't.
Oh, and I should say what I just described was the movie, not the book.
Right.
There is a difference in the ending between those two. Both of them are great, both great endings. But one was the how, like, these two characters' roles get reversed, and now the other one is the underling. And that is like a fate worse than death, at least as far as that story goes.
Yeah, maybe there's something to that. But, like, if... because, like, as you said, like, in that movie and in that book, nobody dies. There's not actual, like... well, there's violence, but it's not lethal. Like, no one's really trying to kill other people. And, I don't know, maybe, like, verbal violence, or that kind of like social pecking order, maybe that could be even more brutal than physical violence, because,
or your options could die. I mean, yeah. your first choice was this wizard. The wizard dies. Even if the party needs a wizard, your options are other things. Of course, I'm looking at like D&D, but if you're playing other games, if you're playing like vampire or something, and you want to play this type of vampire, then that vampire gets staked and put out in the sun, and next up you got to play somebody different. You can't make, you know, that old character Mark II.
Right.
So your options have died in a sense. Our final theme is winter. People familiar with the cover of the first Game of Thrones paperback, and I think the hardcover as well, is a scene in the winter, guy riding in the snow.
Now it's the Iron Throne and Sean Bean.
Yeah. And, of course, the motto of House Stark is Winter is Coming. And people, well, why you'd be listening to a George R. R. Martin episode if you didn't know this, but, of course, there's the long winter and the long seasons is a feature of the world. But that's come up in other stories. For example, Dying of the Light, where the planet is spinning out of control, or it's moving away from the sun, so it's becoming increasingly colder. And it's, as you would imagine, pretty fatalistic as people come to accept that.
Right.
Or come to terms with that, I should say.
Well, again, there's kind of some of that in Game of Thrones, obviously, because of the motto, but...
And the winter.
Well, yeah. Of course, that too. Literally, winter is coming. But if you kind of look at it in another sense, you know, a lot of things are ending because, you know, winter's kind of the final season. So it doesn't have to be literal.
It can be literal, but it doesn't have to be a little short because I, even in a literal sense, the way he's playing with the seasons, that's really fun. But like you said, it could be a metaphorical winter where things are coming to an end. Things are going to die.
Yeah, exactly. A lot
and
of people are dying.
It's inevitable. No.
Well, I remember you saying before, Lyle, how you liked the Maester characters because, like, in the setting, the Maesters kind of represented the birth and growth of science. And they also signaled kind of the death of magic. You know, and throughout the Game of Thrones stories, we're constantly being told, you know, or other characters being told about how, you know, magic was at one time a pretty strong force in this world, and now it's not, and how magic doesn't exist anymore. And that's kind of a winter, in a sense. You know, this thing has died and kind of doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I mean, rebirth, something happening, out with the old and with the new. No, that doesn't sound very exciting.
You know what sounds exciting? Spring. Oh, did I mention that spring is, hey, dragons!
Yeah. No, wait. Spring of fire. Well, you could certainly play winter as an inevitable thing, which is what we were suggesting. Or you could do something like was done in the film Fire and Ice. Ralph Bakshi animated movie.
Right.
Where you have this glacier moving towards and taking over. And it, in a sense, seems inevitable, but it is certainly something that can be stopped. So you could have your players race to try to stop some sort of inevitable thing. There's a, I really wish I picked it up. Or if I picked it up, that I kept it. But it was a Star Wars adventure called Supernova.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is that a star is going to go supernova, and you got to get off the planet. And that's pretty exciting. I'm reading Annihilation by from Marvel, the Annihilation series, and it's not terribly new. And in that, there's this inevitability, this annihilation wave, and just the different stories that you can tell, not necessarily defeating the annihilation wave, but just surviving and living another day.
Or not, if you go on the broken plans theme.
Yeah, oh, the plans broke. Darn. I did the noble thing. Darn.
Yeah. Oh, I fell in love with that person. Oh, darn.
Limitation of a broken starship not working here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would actually be a pretty crappy game. Okay, and giant annihilation wave coming. Everything is broken. You're completely hobbled. The plans don't work. It's inevitable that this annihilation wave will hit you. It's like, why are we playing?
How is my pacifist and limitation working? Not well. Yeah. Yeah, but I guess the winter can be something that's just so big that it's hard to wrap your head around.
Hmm.
But perhaps could be avoided.
Well, and again, like, as you said, winter could be this big inevitable thing, but after winter, hopefully comes spring. So maybe that's a way to keep out, or no, I'll start that again. Maybe that's a way to prevent a sense of hopelessness in the game, in the fact that, yeah, winter is coming, pun, but there will be a spring afterwards. Just maybe not a lot of people will see it.
All right, well, that ends our episode. All right, that ends our episode on George R. R. Martin. Or I suppose it would be our third episode on George R. R. Martin's, because we do have those two Game of Thrones episodes.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Back when I still liked the show. Right.
Yeah, remember we were so excited?
I know.
Oh, man.
Well, in all honesty, I've finished. I'm current now. I finished season 3, and
well, I haven't finished season 2.
Hmm.
Oh, you know what I found out, though?
What?
George, Martin's told the showrunners of A Game of Thrones what's going to happen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So if he dies, they'll be able to finish the series.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like, if George R. R. Martin dies, the book series would not progress. But you would have to wait until the TV series reveals what happens to all the characters at the end.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of surprised to hear that, because, you know...
I think that would be frustrating, because they would do something, and you would never really believe, like, I don't know, they would have to produce something for the fans to show that that's what Martin really wanted to have happen with these characters.
Right, right.
Because you know you're never going to be able to please everybody, either Martin in the books or in the TV series. So if he does die and it's not actually him, people are going to be exceptionally critical.
Right.
Saying, oh, that would never, you know, Jimmy Lannister would never do that, or Jon Snow would never do that. Da, da, da.
Right. That's why they need to get it written down. Like, right here, it says, this is what happened. And that's your R. R. Martin's signature right there.
Can also see him, Martin, wanting to do that as the backup plan, because you don't have somebody else writing his work. Like, there's a difference between, like, writing the TV series than writing, like, books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how happy Frank Herbert would have been if he'd read how his son and the other guy finished his series. So obviously playing in a George R. R. Martin game is going to be very brutal, very risque, but could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I definitely think so. But again, I think it's one of those games where you, as you said, you kind of have to be upfront with everybody involved and make sure everybody kind of agrees to that social contract.
Yeah, like a little checklist. So are people cool with incest? Yes? No? No? All right.
Okay. Yeah. Character death? Yep. Pointless character death? Yep.
Yeah.
Character death for doing the right thing? Yep. Okay.
Yeah. Sense of futility? Yes? No? No? Okay.
Severe limitations? Yeah. Okay. You should make up a little checklist. Are you comfortable with? Yes, yes, yes. Okay.
Okay, regular D&D it is. All right, cool, guys.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, and I got to do the thing. Look at that.
All right.
Yep.
Check us online.
All right. How does Chris it? All right, thanks for joining us on Idle Red Hands. You can check us out at www.idleredhands.com. That's idleredhands.com. You can follow us on Twitter. You can comment on the Facebook page, or you can send us an email, because, yeah, we love reading your emails. And
You can also follow us on Stitcher and iTunes.
Thank you. That's right. You can.
And did you see our Drive-Thru RPG?
No, I didn't. And this is why Chris usually does it. So you can also find our episodes on Drive-Thru RPG. I think that's everything.
They needed to hear you repeat what I just said.
I'm sure they did.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Drive-Thru RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Oh,
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.